Hi, we have some exciting news. Crime House Plus and Murder True Crime Stories are celebrating America's 250th by dropping a four-part limited series on the crimes that built America. These are the crimes and cases that gave us Miranda rights, sparked criminal profiling, and a murder that built America's missing children movement. Follow Murder True Crime Stories for a new episode every Monday leading up to July 4th, or you can listen to all of them right now with Crime House Plus. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of the show's page.
This is Crime House.
Lacey Peterson looked like she had the perfect life, newly married, pregnant, and building a future with the man she loved. But behind that picture-perfect marriage, something was already going very wrong. Throughout their relationship, Lacey's husband, Scott, had lied, cheated, and manipulated the people closest to him, while everyone around him kept giving him the benefit of the doubt. So how did a warm, hopeful young woman end up married to a man who may have been hiding something far darker? When Lacey disappeared, this case forced America to confront how easily charm can mask deception, and how the most dangerous red flags are often the ones people explain away until it's too late. Today, I'm going back to the beginning, who Lacey Peterson was, how she fell in love with Scott, and the early warning signs in his life and their marriage that would take on a chilling new meaning after she vanished. Every crime tells a story about the people involved, the system that tried to stop it, and the nation that couldn't look away. Some cases are so shocking, so deeply woven into who we are that decades later, we're still asking, how did this happen? I'm Katie Ring, and this is America's Most Infamous Crimes. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'll take you deep into cases that have a lasting imprint on society and still haunt us today. I want to thank you for being part of the Crime House community. Please rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes wherever you get your podcasts. And to get all episodes at once ad-free, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. Before I get started, please be advised that this episode contains descriptions of physical and sexual assault and murder, so please listen with care. This is the first of our three-episode series on the murder of Lacey Peterson. Today, I'll take a look at who Lacey really was, this warm, outgoing woman who grew up on a dairy farm in California and was a romantic at heart. I will also look at the man she married, Scott Peterson, and how some of the earliest red flags in his life got explained away by everyone around him until it was too late. This is the story of Lacey Peterson. Her life, her disappearance, and her murder. But to really understand what happened to her, we first need to know the story of the man who came to define both her life and her death. Scott Peterson was born on October 24, 1972, in San Diego, California. He came from a blended family. His dad, Lee, owned a crate packaging company, and his mom, Jackie, ran a clothing boutique in La Jolla called The Put On. Between them, Lee and Jackie had six kids from previous marriages. Scott was the only one they had together, the baby of a big family. And in a lot of ways, it showed. Now, there's nothing earth-shattering about parents babying the youngest kid. Any older sibling will happily tell you that their little brother or sister had it easier. But with Scott, his home life may have been a little too comfortable. The Petersons weren't exactly swimming in money. They lived in a small two-bedroom apartment, and Scott shared a room with his half-brother, John. But his parents gave him everything they could. Lee Peterson had grown up poor in Minnesota and was determined to give Scott the kind of childhood he never had. Jackie doted on him as well. So when Scott found a hobby he was into, they let him go all in on it. And for Scott, that hobby was golf. His parents started bringing him along to the Stardust Country Club in San Diego when he was still in elementary school. By the time Scott was 14, he was better than Lee. Golf became his whole identity, to the point where Scott thought he had what it took to go pro. And by the time he graduated from the University of San Diego High School, he was one of the top junior golfers in the area, good enough to land a partial scholarship to Arizona State University. His coach called him a popular teammate and a leader, but at least one of his teammates had a different take. He thought Scott was full of himself and that he bragged constantly about how much better he was than everybody else. One of his high school classmates, by the way, was Phil Mickelson, who actually did become a professional golfer. So maybe Scott's confidence was a little misplaced. And almost immediately at ASU, he proved that. When Scott got to college, he seemed to like partying more than working on his game. One night, he took a visiting high school golf recruit out to a party, and the kid got wasted. His dad found out, called the coach, and just like that, Scott was off of the team before the season even started, scholarship and all. Now, to his credit, he did seem to learn from it. After losing his spot at Arizona State, Scott transferred to Cuesta College, a community college in San Luis Obispo, California, and worked three jobs while playing on their golf team for the next 2 years. Once he found his footing, he enrolled at California Polytechnic State University, or Cal Poly, in the same town. He finally seemed ready to leave golf behind and buckle down by majoring in agricultural business. At least one professor described him as a model student. He was studying hard and working at a restaurant about 20 minutes from the campus called Pacific Cafe, a little spot in the coastal town of Morro Bay. And it was there in 1994 that his life collided with a 19-year-old named Lacey Rocha. Lacey was also a student at Cal Poly, and before I keep going with the story, let me tell you a little more about her. Lacey was born on May 4th, 1975 to Sharon and Dennis Rocha. They'd met in high school and owned a dairy farm together just west of Escalon, a small town in California's Central Valley. Lacey had an older brother, Brent, and from a young age, both kids worked the farm. It wasn't glamorous, but it gave Lacey something she'd carry with her the rest of her life, a genuine love of the outdoors, of getting her hands in the dirt, of growing things. Her parents divorced in 1977 when Lacey was just two. Sharon took the kids and moved to the city of Modesto, but Lacey and Brent still spent weekends at their dad's ranch. During the week, Lacey gardened with her mom, and that became their thing, this quiet ritual they shared. On weekends, she'd explore the wide open farmland with her dad. It was a split life, but Lacey seemed to draw something good from both sides. Her mom started dating a man named Ron Grantsky not long after the divorce, and Ron stepped into a parental role. He helped raise both kids from the time Lacey was a toddler. He even had a nickname for her, Jabberjaws, because this girl never stopped talking. And honestly, that tracks with everything people have to say about her. Lacey was charming, outgoing, and full of energy. She was a cheerleader in junior high and high school and played softball as well. She was honest, sometimes too honest, and she had this quality where if you were in a room with her, you knew it. She wasn't mean-spirited, but she was absolutely her own person. And if you didn't like that, well, Lacey had plenty of other friends who did. Her mom, Sharon, would later say that even as a baby, Lacey was like that. She said Lacey started sleeping through the night almost right away, and every morning when Sharon went to get her out of the crib, she'd wake up with a smile on her face. By the time she got to Thomas Downey High School in Modesto, Lacey was definitely one of the popular girls. At 15, she got her first serious boyfriend, a guy named Kent Gain. They stayed together even after Kent graduated, and when Lacey enrolled at Cal Poly in 1993, Kent actually picked up and moved to the area so they could be together. Lacey channeled her love of plants and nature into a major in ornamental horticulture, taking classes like landscape design, hothouse garden production, pest control, and floral design. It was the perfect combination of the gardening she'd done with her mom and the hands-on skills she picked up on her dad's farm. She and Kent rented a small place near campus in Morro Bay, right in the same area as the Pacific Cafe where Scott Peterson worked. They spent most of their time cooking at home and working in their garden. It was a quiet, settled little life for two people barely in their 20s. Now, because of Lacey's infectious personality, she made a ton of friends at school. But whenever they invited her out, she'd usually head home to Kent instead. And that rubbed her friends the wrong way. Not because they didn't like Lacey, but because they were not fans of Kent. They thought he was condescending. They didn't think that he appreciated her nearly enough, and there was just something about the dynamic that made them uneasy. So when the two broke up a bit after Lacey's 19th birthday in May of 1994, her friends were thrilled. And Lacey didn't seem all that torn up about it either. She moved on quickly, focusing on school and her job at Cal Poly's plant and floral shop. And here's a dark footnote that's hard to ignore. It turned out to be a very good thing that Lacey left Kent when she did, because 5 years after they split up, Kent Gain shot the woman he was dating. He was arrested, convicted, and sentenced to 15 years in prison. When Lacey vanished in 2002, her family actually thought of Kent first, but he was already locked up in Washington State Prison. So at least one dangerous man from Lacey's life could be accounted for. As for the next one, she was about to meet him. A couple of months after ending things with Kent, Lacey was at the Pacific Cafe in the summer of 1994, flirting with a handsome waiter named Scott Peterson. The two hit it off almost instantly, and Lacey, this outgoing, talk-to-anyone, jabber-jaws girl, got shy. She wrote her phone number on a piece of paper, but instead of giving it to Scott herself, she handed it to a friend to pass along. But for Lacey, this was a lot more serious than an innocent crush. According to her mom, Lacey had this feeling about Scott. Before they'd even gone on a single date, she told Sharon, "I've met the man I'm going to marry." Maybe the sincerity got lost in translation on Scott's end because he thought the note with her number was a joke and ended up throwing it in the trash. It wasn't until someone told him the gesture was serious that he dug it out, called Lacey up, and asked her on a date. On their first date, Scott planned for them to do one of his favorite things. He took her out on a boat for a deep sea fishing trip. However, Lacey was less impressed by the boating life than Scott had hoped because she was seasick the entire time. But in spite of that rocky start, Scott came in strong in all of the right ways. Roses, good wine, nice restaurants. He was charming with her family and even brought flowers for her mom on top of the ones he got for Lacey. Before long, Lacey's whole family was just as taken with him as she was. Scott was smart, well-spoken, and good-looking. He seemed like the kind of guy who had his act together, the kind of guy who would take care of her. After 2 years of dating, Lacey and Scott moved in together. She gave him a puppy for Christmas that year, cementing the picture of young domestic bliss. About a year after that, in August of 1997, they got married. They were still in college, but they were ready. Or at least, they thought they were. The wedding was at the Sycamore Mineral Springs Resort near San Luis Obispo, and it was straight out of a fairy tale. Small, private, on a beautiful summer day. The photos show exactly what you would expect. Kissing, laughing, and hugging. A young couple on top of the world. It seemed like the good times were just getting started. But their relationship was about to face its first major test. 4 months later, Lacey graduated and landed a job as a wine distributor in Prunedale, about 2 hours away. But Scott still had classes to finish at Cal Poly, so he stayed behind in San Luis Obispo while Lacey set off on her own. Maybe it was the distance, maybe Scott felt like he could get away with more now that she wasn't around. But whatever the reasons, not long after Lacey moved to Prunedale, he started having an affair. Lacey had no idea, but she was about to find out in the most shocking way possible. In the early summer of 1998, Scott graduated from Cal Poly with his degree in agricultural business, and Lacey came to town to celebrate. While the two of them were together, Scott's mistress walked in on them. Not only did she not know Lacey was in town, she didn't even know Scott was married. As you can imagine, it turned into a massive fight. But here's the part that really breaks my heart. Lacey didn't tell anyone what actually happened because she didn't want her friends to hate Scott, so she covered for him. The most she said to one friend was that Scott wasn't acting like a married man. That was it. No details beyond that. And I think that tells you something important about Lacey. Even in the middle of being hurt and betrayed, she was protecting him, protecting the picture of their life together, the love story she wanted so badly to be real. After Scott graduated, they tried to put it behind them or at least push it to the side. Lacey moved back to San Luis Obispo, and together they decided to open a business. They bought an old bakery in a strip mall and converted it into a sports bar called The Shack. Scott ran the kitchen while Lacey handled the design and the vibe. It was a ton of work, and they did it all without any financial help from their parents. Scott even flew down to Los Angeles for a certification course just so he could install a ventilation system they couldn't afford to hire someone for. But the hustle paid off. The Shack turned into a solid college hangout, especially on the weekends. and things seemed to be going well beyond just business. On top of running the bar, Lacey and Scott loved to host dinner parties at their place. Lacey even took a culinary course in France. From the outside, the Petersons looked exactly like the kind of young couple you'd root for. Ambitious, in love, building something together. For a while, things really did seem back on track. But cracks were forming once again. When they started looking to buy a house, they ran into the same wall a lot of young couples hit. They couldn't afford to stay where they were. The market in San Luis Obispo was just too expensive. So in the year 2000, they put the shack up for sale and moved to Lacey's hometown of Modesto. And that was important to Lacey because she was ready to become a mom. Scott, on the other hand, wasn't sold on fatherhood. But Lacey kept pushing, and maybe she figured that if he ever did come around, at least they'd be near her family, near her mom, Ron, and the people who'd supported her all her life. And it didn't take long for them to find the right place. In October of 2000, they bought a 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom bungalow for $177,000. It was a nice neighborhood near East La Loma Park, the kind of tree-lined street where you could picture a family growing up. It seemed like the perfect place for a new start. But before long, their dream move turned into a nightmare. After moving back to Modesto, Lacey threw herself into fixing up their new house and making it theirs. She had a gift for that, turning a space into something warm and inviting. Meanwhile, Scott got a job working as a salesman for Trade Corp, a fertilizer company where he served as their West Coast representative. As for Lacey, she switched gears from the wine industry and became a substitute teacher. She liked the flexibility and the schedule made sense, especially if she ever did get pregnant, she'd be able to step back easily. And eventually, Scott came around to having kids. Lacey was ecstatic, but she knew getting pregnant wouldn't be easy. She only had one ovary thanks to a surgery from years earlier, so the odds were already stacked against them. Lacey was methodical about it, tracking her cycle every single day, keeping careful notes, and waiting for the right window. But there was one frustrating issue. Scott always seemed to be traveling for work when Lacey was ovulating. Whether that was bad luck or something more deliberate, Lacey didn't know, but it drove her crazy. Still, they kept trying. And in May of 2002, right around Lacey's 27th birthday, she found out she was pregnant. The due date was February 10th, 2003. They learned they were having a boy and even picked out a name, Connor. As the rest of 2002 went by, Lacey threw herself into getting ready for the baby. She pulled back on her substitute teaching hours to spend more time at the house, nesting, cooking, and reconnecting with friends from high school. By all accounts, she was having the time of her life. Scott's mom, Jackie, would later remember a moment from around this time when the family said a small prayer of thanks together. "All of our kids are healthy, no divorces," Jackie recalled saying. "I remember saying how lucky we are, how blessed we are." But the blessings Lacey was counting, Scott was already throwing them away. Because around the same time, October of 2002, while Lacey was entering her third trimester, Scott went to a pest management trade show at the Disneyland Hotel in Anaheim. It was a routine work trip, but at the conference, he met a woman named Sean Sibley. Sean would later recall that Scott talked constantly about sex at dinner that first night, even enough to make other people at the table uncomfortable. But he also told her he was looking for a serious long-term relationship. He said he'd lost his soulmate, his way of implying his wife was dead without quite saying the words. He asked Sean if she knew anyone she could introduce him to, someone who wanted something real. Sean was in a committed relationship herself, but she had a friend, a 27-year-old single mother named Amber Fry, who was struggling to make ends meet while raising her young daughter alone. Amber had gone to community college, worked as a preschool teacher, and then trained as a massage therapist. She was looking for stability, for a partner, for someone who'd show up. Sean thought Scott could be that guy for her and gave him Amber's contact info. But then a few weeks went by and he didn't reach out to her. Sean actually emailed Scott to ask why he hadn't called yet, and then finally he did. Their first date was on November 20th, 2002. Amber met Scott at the Elephant Bar in Fresno, about 90 miles south of Modesto. She got there early and waited by the entrance, butterflies in her stomach. When Scott walked in, just over 6 feet tall, wearing a nice suit, he lit up when he saw her and gave her a small kiss on the cheek. Whether it had just been a long drive or Scott was already thinking ahead, he'd already booked a hotel room. And before they headed to dinner, he invited her up for champagne and strawberries. Then he took her to a Japanese restaurant where he reserved a private dining room, and they talked until the place closed. After that, they went to a karaoke bar where he convinced her to sing a duet. They slow danced, they kissed, and finally they went back to his hotel. Over the next few weeks, Scott relentlessly love-bombed her. He brought amber roses, he made her dinner, and he even got to know her daughter, carrying her on hikes, reading her books, and picking her up from daycare when Amber asked. Not only that, he bought them a home planetarium, a gift inspired by one of their first dates when they'd competed to see who could spot the first star. Amber was falling for him hard, and she had no reason not to. Scott didn't wear a wedding ring. He told her he lived in Sacramento and had a condo in San Diego. Like his affair in San Luis Obispo, she had no idea he was married, let alone that his wife was due to have a baby in a matter of weeks. Meanwhile, back in Modesto, Lacey was entering the home stretch of her pregnancy. She and Scott had an annual tradition. Every year, they'd drive down to San Luis Obispo for a holiday party with their old Cal Poly friends. Lacey was especially excited to go this year, one last hurrah before the baby came. But it wasn't going to happen. Scott told her his boss was in town. There was a big meeting he just couldn't miss. At least, that's what Lacey told her friend. But the truth was, Scott wasn't in Modesto. He wasn't meeting with his boss. He was down in Fresno with Amber. He blew off their tradition, their friends, his pregnant wife, to be with a woman Lacey didn't even know existed. And then around early December, something, or should I say someone, forced Scott's hand. Sean Sibley, the woman who'd introduced them, found out through a business contact that Scott was married. She was furious. She confronted him and told him he had to tell Amber the truth, or she would. So Scott told Amber, sort of. He called her on December 9th, 2002, and said the reason he'd been single when they met was because he was a widower. He said he'd lost his wife and that this Christmas would be his first one without her. Now think about that for a second. His wife is alive, she's at home, she's 8 months pregnant with his child, and he's telling another woman that she's dead. Amber felt bad for Scott, so she comforted him. She asked him if he still wanted to pursue a serious relationship with her, and he said absolutely. It was a lie she believed, but in a matter of weeks, she would learn the real truth about Scott Peterson. At the end of each episode, I like to take a moment to answer any questions you may have about the case and share my thoughts. So make sure to comment below.
They got married so young. Does that tell us something about Scott's impulsiveness, a lack of real consideration for what he was committing to, that ends up having deadly consequences later?
For me, getting married young alone doesn't tell us as much because plenty of people get married young and build stable, committed lives. The more interesting question to me is why Scott married young and what that reveals about his psychology. Because impulsiveness implies someone who acts without thinking. But Scott appears to have been the opposite in many ways. He was calculated, charming, and controlled in public. But behind the scenes, he started cheating on Lacey almost immediately after the wedding. Personally, I think Scott is a narcissist who wanted to get married because it fit the image he wanted to project. He wanted the house, the attractive wife, the respectable life. In my opinion, what he lacked was an impulse control. It was genuine emotional investment in the reality behind his image. He seemed to treat major life commitments, marriage, impending fatherhood, as things that happened to his image rather than grappled with them. So when those commitments became inconvenient or constraining, there's no evidence he seriously wrestled with them emotionally. Instead, he just kind of started managing the problems, and that absence of genuine internal conflict, more than any impulsiveness, is what really makes this case so chilling.
Why all the affairs? Why can't Scott stay faithful? Is it because he got married too young and wanted more time to play the field? Or is there something darker here about his need to control and manipulate women?
I think the married too young and wanted to play the field answer is probably the explanation Scott would give himself, because it gives him some kind of sympathy. I mean, lots of people feel constrained by early marriage and handle it by having honest conversations, you know, seeking counseling or getting divorced in some cases. But Scott didn't do any of that. He maintained his marriage and his affairs simultaneously and with apparent ease, because he was someone who just enjoyed having both. And we will get into the biggest affair tomorrow, but these weren't just casual hookups. He wasn't just cheating in a one-time pursuit. He actually pursued women in ways that were emotionally intensive. He led these women on, promising them a future and never disclosing that he was actually already married. And again, I don't know for sure if Scott is a narcissist, but he definitely has a lot of those qualities. And despite narcissists coming off as very confident and cocky, they are actually deeply insecure, which means they are perpetually dependent on outside supply, admiration, desire, and envy from others to feel okay about themselves. And this is exactly where cheating comes in with narcissists, is that from each new person who finds them attractive or fascinating or desirable, it gives them a hit of validation that temporarily soothes that underlying insecurity. And in these cases, the long-term partner stops providing that hit because familiarity sets in. They know your flaws. They've seen you fail. They don't look at you with those fresh eyes anymore, like a new person in your life would. So the affairs weren't really about the people at all. It's about what the person's attention does for the narcissist's fragile sense of self.
Not to victim blame at all, but it's really striking that both of Lacey's serious boyfriends ended up serving jail time for violence against women. What does that tell us about the kind of women that predatory men tend to target?
This makes me so frustrated because I've seen a lot of people blame Lacey or comment on her choice of men, but people who do this don't understand the dynamics of abuse at all, especially when it comes to re-victimization. Because the reality is, predatory men aren't just looking for low self-esteem. They're often looking for someone who has a specific unhealed wound, a woman who had a previous abusive or neglectful relationship, has a demonstrated need for consistent love and reassurance, which for a woman is not a character flaw. It's a completely human response to being hurt. But it does make the love bombing that abusers do extraordinarily effective, because it's targeting exactly what she's been starved of in this past relationship. It also creates a sort of he's better than before trap, where they compare their old relationship to this new relationship. And so when Lacey compared Scott to her previous abusive boyfriend, Scott probably seemed like a dream. He was charming, attractive, generous, stable. And the bar had been lowered by the previous relationship, which meant behaviors that might have raised red flags for someone without that history seemed like evidence that Scott was actually genuinely different. And predatory men benefit enormously from following abusers, because the comparison does half of the work for them, especially when it comes for victims falling for that love bombing. And re-victimization isn't a pattern of bad choices. It's more of a pattern of targeted hunting by these abusers. We tend to look at a woman who's been in two bad relationships and ask what she's doing wrong. But the more accurate question is what predatory men are doing right, which is systematically identifying and pursuing women whose histories make them much more responsive to manipulation. So the victim isn't really repeating a mistake. She's being hunted by people who specialize in finding her. Also, coming back to narcissists, a lot of them will see traits in others that they wish to possess themselves. And Lacey was this girl who was full of life and everyone loved her, which is something that many narcissists crave. But when the narcissist realized that they can't possess those traits themselves, They start to kind of resent their partner and become jealous of them, which can turn very dangerous in many scenarios. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode. Make sure to rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes so we can keep building this community together. And to get all episodes at once ad-free, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. Come back tomorrow for our next episode on the murder of Lacey Peterson.